morning. My name is Michael McCusker. The U.S. House of Representatives will apparently vote today on an anti-lynching bill, which it hopes will become law before the end of this Black History Month. You might be surprised that after more than a century, the USA has not made lynching illegal. But then, maybe not. Strange fruit, as Billie Holiday sang. And as Frederick Douglass said, where justice is denied, where poverty is enforced, where ignorance prevails, and where one class is made to feel that society is an organized conspiracy to oppress, rob, and degrade them, neither persons nor property will be safe. I start today's program with something I have written. It's not just breeding. Quite a few years ago, a now-deceased television celebrity seriously gaffed himself when he said that most people are born with equal intelligence, but blacks have watered down their genes because the less intelligent ones are the ones that have the most children. He later defended his slip of the brain. I said the least fit are proliferating, and I didn't say blacks. Whatever the ensuing imbroglio and its consequences, he was suspended from TV for a few months, and however his true beliefs, whether he was racist or just plain elitist, champion of breeding only by people of breeding. He did point out an increasing problem about the worldwide human overpopulation explosion. Humanity seems more prolific than rats. The more people there are, the many, many more people there will continue to be, times the many-ness, no matter what their status. And as Abraham Lincoln said, God must love poor people because he made so many of them, himself included. Most of the world's children are born hungry, with little chance for education or sustaining employment other than the most menial and meager, and most die very early. The aforementioned essentially forgotten celebrity was wrong, however, to attribute the problem of breeding solely to the people begetting children. After all, rich or poor, educated or illiterate, black, white, or etc., humanity's single, compelling, and insensate purpose is to breed, to instinctively and virtually mindlessly perpetuate the species, whether it is a good idea or not. The implication was and remains that intelligent folk are losing headway, that they don't multiply as rapidly as the mentally deficient, and by default implies also the wrong racial groups are grossly replicating. Yet given for millions of years at least that adolescence has been prime breeding time for human reproduction, despite modern society's disapproval, perhaps an unwed teenage mother from the inner city has a better chance of producing healthier stock than 30-something gentrifites who postpone childbirth for material potential and relinquish genetic potency. As a result, the remark that the least fit are carelessly proliferating does not probe the circumstances that might qualify some people less fit to reproduce than others. And if it does indeed target blacks, it is actually on the mark, though for quite opposite reasons than the prejudicial racial implications. Impoverishment, malnutrition, chronic unemployment, lack of education, or the opportunity for education are major factors toward dissolving the prospects and potency of a community, a nation, a race. They are not the result of inferior genes, but of defective social and political policies and prejudices that might rightly, though cautiously, be called genocide. Blacks in America have always been a suppressed people. Slave or free, their arduous, tragic, and unequal role in building and defending the nation has always been devalued and generally ignored. Although the word history seems to imply only white male Western European predominance over world affairs. The black struggle for political and civic equality, especially in the last generation, has been the closest to the revolution of the Enlightenment that gave birth to the American nation than any other. This struggle has actually been a racial equality epilogue to the political independence that the revered Yankee Doodle ancestors started, but unfortunately denied people of color, and that's a quote, who were regarded as property and not as human beings born equal and certainly not born free. White supremacy groups grew up on the fringes of Southern rage at their defeat in the Civil War and the abolition of slavery. The most infamously murderous were the Knight Riders of the Ku Klux Klan. Lynching of blacks were commonplace following the Civil War and lasted until the sixth decade of the 20th century. The only verified lynching in Oregon occurred in February 1902, when a black citizen of Coos Bay was shot multiple times by a so-called white posse, and his dead body was strung up to a tree. Black Americans remain without significant positions of power two decades into the 21st century, the major exception Barack Obama's two-term presidency of 2009 to 2017. And although the exceptional civil rights movement in the 1950s and 1960s dramatized and somewhat improved black prospects, the pervasive racism that saturates American culture continues to strip away the few advances that were made half a century ago. The virulent pervasiveness of racial intolerance vastly accelerating during the current presidency of Donald Trump, who perniciously dismantles everything Obama accomplished. The renewed vengeful backlash of prejudice and oppression against black Americans for having dared challenge white supremacy is revealed as more insidious than neo-apartheid if it is understood that the underlying intent is for them to indeed, literally, breed into helpless oblivion without any tangible means of support for survival. With few exceptions, American blacks are contained and isolated in urban ghettos in much the manner Nazis forced Jews into European ghettos, and particularly in the South, secluded in poverty-riven rural archipelagos of tenant farms and shacky towns, segregated also in denied adequate education, employment, housing, and health care, forced to subsist on deleterious doles stingily appropriated, which are exploited as examples of the need to abolish welfare altogether. A voter suppression of black citizens, primarily by Southern Republicans, is continuously manifest despite rulings by state and federal courts. Black rage is forced inward against themselves to eat their own livers, as a friend cogently expressed. The barely constrained contempt too many whites feel toward blacks is probably equally felt toward whites by blacks who are victims of their antipathy, but outnumbered 10-1, and without the tremendous legal strength and firepower of the whites, they are generally unable to strike back without horrendous consequences. The urban city riots of the 20th century, beginning in Chicago just after World War I, and continued through cities like Detroit, Newark, and in Watts, and central Los Angeles, the Martin Luther King assassination reprisal riots in several cities, including Washington, D.C., in 1968, perhaps the worst being the white rage that destroyed the black business district of Tulsa, Oklahoma, in 1921 in revenge for a never-proven rape of a white woman by a black man, 300 killed, the overwhelming majority being blacks, known to history as a race massacre. Nearly all of the black rage that was manifested in these feudal insurrections were essentially crowds of angry blacks mauling their own neighborhoods, inflicting destruction and homelessness upon themselves and neighbors, while police and National Guards assaulted black communities to contain violence within ghetto boundaries, even as it lashed out against non-black owned or operated food markets, liquor stores, loan shark syndicates, and other non-black businesses in the black communities that were torched and looted. Exposure to such mass rage and violence is terrifying, whether in sympathy or abhorrence. The howl that roars from the madding crowd, a huge shriek of pain despite the individual epithets of anger, all of which erupt as a result of police obstrusion. White-dominated police forces act in black communities as if they were foreign occupying armies. Most of the time, people patiently suffer the iron heel, as Jefferson recognized in the Declaration of Independence. But an excessively cruel act, such as the acquittal of policemen who savagely beat a young black man in Los Angeles in 1991, can be the final indignity that erupts in violently thermonuclear reaction. Before French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre branded the U.S. war against Vietnam as genocide, he cautioned that the word must be used sparingly and precisely, or it loses its meaning and power. Genocide is defined as the deliberate and systematic destruction of a racial, political, or cultural group. Genocide can be overtly applied through war or by establishing death camps. It can also be carried out more subtly over a long period through political and social attrition. The prevailing white attitude towards blacks was summed up by Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Roger Taney, in 1857, when, speaking for the majority in the Dred Scott case, he stated that Negroes were considered, quote, so far inferior that they had no rights which the white man was bound to respect, unquote. Not all whites are racial supremacists, though most are racist, if not intentionally, usually on impact. Separate standards exist. Somehow it is okay for a white to be armed with a weapon, but dangerous if a black carries a knife or a gun. The KKK can be, if not forgiven, at least explained sympathetically. Black power, however, is a dangerous threat. The fact that most drug addicts are white is dismissed as a personal flaw. Black addiction is thought to be an endemic racial disorder. Whites have fought and many have been injured. Some have died for civil rights for blacks. They have been outspoken and prepared to endure arrest, beatings, and ostracism by other unsympathetic or racist Alvescent citizens. An unlikely supporter of black liberation was Lyndon Baines Johnson. When, as president, he signed the Voting Rights Act and Civil Rights Act of 1965, after pushing them through Congress, he said, "The story of our nation and of the American Negro are like two rivers that flow along divided channels. When the Liberty Bell rang out in Philadelphia, it did not ring for the Negro. It was only at Appomattox," he said, of the end of the Civil War 100 years earlier in 1865, that an American victory was a Negro victory. American history is taught primarily from a white perspective, which is only a portion of our triplicated history. The first three-century portion was eradication of native peoples. The remaining two modes involve integrating the white chronology with black American history, which, without that integration, is a lie that perpetuates the racism that undercuts and embitters our truly pluralistic history. One of Voltaire's friends said there would never be justice, equality, and freedom until the last king is strangled with the intestines of the last priest. He might have included racial supremacists. Not only do they cause most of the human world's troubles, they also substantiate their own general theory of genetic defectibility. As one of my friends once said, skinheads have more hair than brains. And that was something I wrote. It's not just breeding. And now, the case for a more negative Black History Month by Aaron Aubrey Kaplan. Black History Month is traditionally a time to honor Black Americans and theoretically accord them their proper place in American history. Every February, we re-examine the exemplary lives of Harriet Tubman, Charles Drew, Frederick Douglass, and those of lesser known but truly significant leaders, artists, scientists, thinkers, and others. The occasion has always felt too narrow to me. We are eager to celebrate our favorite figures and their trailblazing achievements. Obama is the latest, but less eager to examine the fact that their heroism was based more often than not in fighting an American system that fought and still fights against their status as full Americans. Perhaps it's because Black people don't want to ruin the Black History Month party, and white people would rather not examine their role in the racism that made the month necessary in the first place. I have grumbled for years about the shortcomings I see, but have always come down on the side of celebration. We deserve it. But the party, though God knows we could use one, can't be the point this time. In 2020, at this very perilous moment in the history of us all, it's urgent that we turn the lens around, take off the worthy Black individuals, and put it on Americans as a whole. It's time to acknowledge what Black history really reveals, not individual heroism or the endurance of democratic ideals, but their opposites. Time to examine what Black history has always shown us, how hundreds of years of codified oppression, groupthink, hypocrisy, lies, and political cowardice have made possible and palatable the political oppression and moral corruption of the current moment that threatens to wipe out democracy for everybody. I don't exaggerate. We have already had lots of alarmed postmortems about the recently concluded Senate impeachment trial, in which the Republicans united to ensure no witnesses were called. The party is increasingly recognized as a cult that serves not people. After all, 75% of Americans wanted to see more evidence, but its own interests. It is flaunting this self-interest openly, a la Trump, even suggesting that racist, crude, or unconstitutional acts by the president are simply idiosyncrasies or executive privilege that are ultimately good for democracy. America appears to be, as Susan Sontag might have said, at the end of seriousness. But we have been at this end before. We have always been here. The institution of slavery meant that the Constitution, for all its worthy prescriptions that Representative Adam Schiff defended so eloquently during the House trial, was going to be a document undermined from the beginning by the founders' tacit embrace of that institution. Black history rooted in slavery means that the country was always going to have to make ugly compromises with its own ideals, a process that became normalized. The longevity of slavery meant that business and the pursuit of profit, not justice, would be the dominant force in American life, and that the real energy driving even the most optimistic notions of American exceptionalism. Put in this context, the cult of Trump is not new, just another compromise with our ideals, albeit a far-reaching one that looks particularly bad in the allegedly enlightened post-civil rights era of the 21st century. The good news may be that America is finally feeling the embarrassment about the flaws in its national character that it should have felt 400 years ago. Embarrassment is not moral outrage. But it's a start. The civil rights revolt of the 1960s was greatly aided by the images on television of police dogs and white officers attacking Black protesters who were only seeking the right to sit at lunch counters and shop at department stores. It was bad public relations for America, and in the end, bad for business. That was then. Embarrassment, forget moral outrage, is totally lacking now among Republicans who will willingly take their cues from a man incapable of feeling remorse or regret for any reason. Far from being embarrassed, the cult now seems to be saying that racism and corporate supremacy are, if not actually good for business, conditions we can all and perhaps should live with. Again, not new. We all lived with the economics of Jim Crow for 100 years. But in 2020, the consequences of clinging to the status quo are incredibly far-reaching. What we must come to grips with is that the arrogance and myopia that made our race-based social caste system possible, that allowed us to dishonor our Constitution and delude ourselves on a regular basis, are the same arrogance and myopia that are now threatening the well-being of the entire planet. Denying climate change is part and parcel of denying the corrosive effects of segregation. The point is that America is very good at making its own reality, which is another way of saying it has always tolerated, even welcomed, fake news and alternate facts for the sake of power and political convenience. All this month, I have wondered, would Harriet Tubman at all have been surprised at this state of affairs? I think not. Disappointed for sure, but not surprised. I doubt any black freedom fighter expected a country so wedded to inequality to significantly change in his or her lifetime or ours. Yet if we as a country don't significantly change our view of our own history, which is framed in black history, there will be precious little in the future to celebrate. And that was The Case for a More Negative Black History Month, by Aaron Aubrey Kaplan, who is a contributing writer to the New York Times, and she wrote this for the Times. And now, by Dr. Robert Brake of Ocean Park, Washington, a noteworthy day. Today, February 27th, is a noteworthy day. It's the birth date of Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, whom Walt Whitman called the poet of sympathetic gentleness, and whose poetry helped shape American character and its legacy. It is also the birth date of Grapes of Wrath novelist John Steinbeck, whom I admire for his keen social perception. And it's the birth date of groundbreaking American classical and spiritual singer Marian Anderson, an important figure in the struggle for black artists to overcome racial prejudice in the United States during the 20th century. Her legendary 1939 Easter Sunday tour de force happened after tireless reformer and advocate for social justice Eleanor Roosevelt resigned in protest from the Daughters of the American Revolution, who refused to allow Marian Anderson to perform at the DAR's Constitution Hall, not far from the White House. The DAR's venue, the group claimed, was for white artists only, quote-unquote, triggering Eleanor Roosevelt's resignation and prompting Anderson to remark, "I am not surprised at Mrs. Roosevelt's action because she seems to me to be the one who really comprehends the true meaning of democracy." An alternative plan took shape. The Interior Department under Secretary Harold Ickes would invite Anderson to sing at the Lincoln Memorial. An African-American who had won global acclaim, Anderson had, quote, "a voice one hears once in 100 years, remarked the great conductor Arturo Toscanini. At the April 9th, 1939 concert, Anderson sang, "America, my country, 'tis of thee. Ave Maria, O mio Fernando, my soul is anchored in the Lord, gospel train, and nobody knows the troubles I've seen," in a 25-minute concert attended by 75,000. A consummate professional, Anderson was nevertheless overwhelmed by the crowd and the setting. Washington singer and voice teacher Todd Duncan concluded that the sight of Abraham Lincoln with this black woman standing in a beautiful fur coat in front of a big Steinway piano singing "My Country, 'Tis of Thee" is a thing you don't see or hear or feel every day. I know my soul has it, and it will never, ever leave. And that was Todd Duncan. New Deal Arts Administrator Edward Bruce remarked that the concert was the most civilized thing that has happened in this country for a long time. Remarking on her rich contralto voice, Harold Ickes linked past and present, asserting that genius like justice is blind, for genius with the tip of her wing has touched this woman. Genius draws no color line. The impressions of the 1939 Eastern afternoon were borne out over the years. It was a tour de force that stirred and sensitized the national psyche to the reality of racial discrimination, the Washington Post Bart Barnes wrote in his 1993 obituary of Anderson. That afternoon concert came to loom large in the history of the fight for racial equality. Historian Scott A. Sandage wrote that the concert was significantly the first black mass action to evoke laudatory national publicity and earn a positive place in American public memory. And that was Scott Sandage. Days after the concert, acclaimed journalist Ernest Lindley exuded the rich contralto voice of this colored girl out of the slums of Philadelphia, singing from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, made everyone who heard her feel a little nobler. Anderson served for several years as a delegate to the United Nations Human Rights Committee and as a goodwill ambassador for the United States Department of State, giving concerts all over the world. She participated in the civil rights movement in the 1960s and received numerous awards and honors, including the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the Congressional Gold Medal, the Kennedy Center Honors, the National Medal of Arts, and a Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award. 20 years ago today, writer Garrison Keillor noted in his writer's almanac, "You never heard in her voice a single tone of meanness, bitterness, or blame. There is something saintly in that, something deeply human and good." Well said. And Marian Anderson died April 8, 1993, in Portland, Oregon. And Dr. Robert Drake, of course, is from Ocean Park, Washington. And a personal note, my great-grandmother also quit the DAR over the choice to not have Marian Anderson sing that Easter day. This is Michael McCusker. Happy Leap Day. And a passing question. How many cruise ships does Astoria plan to host in light of the coronavirus?